Well, welcome to Archaeology News Weekly. Apologies for the bit break, but it has been, as they say, busy, busy, busy. Anyway, this is the Archaeology News Weekly, and I am, as ever, David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And then the main headlines from around the world are as follows. It turns out that Oslo is far older than previously thought. There are grisly signs of mass cannibalism in the Neolithic, and Zut alors, French immigrants founded the first British farms. China's early Bronze Age manufactured is study, and there is hope that a Canadian prehistoric site can be saved. On a 4,000-year-old grave unearthed in Iraq, this time by archaeologists. Ancient gold is discovered at a grave site in southern Hungary, whilst it's a blast from the past with sound waves and ancient Maltese temples. We report on a couple of lectures at the Wiltshire Heritage Museum, and then tell a tale of two boulders in Scotland. There's also more on the ancient Super River that cut Britain off from Europe, and finally, Paleolithic cave paintings are found in central India. Archaeologists say Oslo's history will have to be rewritten. They've made new excavations east of the capital, the largest city in Norway, which shows that people have lived there on the Ekeberg Heights for 10,000 years. The artefacts found include flint flakes and other evidence of tool production, which show that people lived there more than 2,000 years longer than experts previously believed. The new find includes a settlement, which in these days was located at the water's edge, but is now found high up in the hillside as the land rose after the ice that was covering much of the area disappeared. This is called isostatic rebound. Around 8 to 12 people would have lived in this newly discovered settlement. So not so much the city of Oslo being older, but shall we say rather the location. At a settlement in what is now southern Germany, the menu turned gruesome 7,000 years ago. Over a period of perhaps a few decades, hundreds of people were butchered and eaten before parts of their bodies were thrown into pits, a new study is suggesting. Anthropologist Bruno Bullishnin of the University of Bordeaux proposes cannibalism at the village, now called Herxheim, may have occurred during ceremonies in which people from near and far brought slaves, war prisoners and other dependents for ritual sacrifice. The researchers suspect a social and political crisis in Central Europe at the time, which was triggering these various forms of violence. Human sacrifice at Herxheim is a hypothesis that's difficult to prove right now, but they have evidence that several hundred people were eaten over a brief period of time. Skeletal markings indicate that human bodies were butchered in the same way as animals. Herxheim offers rare evidence of cannibalism during Europe's early Neolithic period, when farming first spread. Artifacts come from the Linear Pottery culture, or the Linear Band Keramik culture, which flourished in Western and Central Europe from about 7,500 to 7,000 years ago. If further work confirms large-scale cannibalism at the village, this would be very surprising indeed, simply in terms of the scale involved. The German site was first excavated in 1996 and then explored again between 2005 and 2008. Pottery resting amongst the bones accumulated over no more than a few decades. Some pieces came from Neolithic sites located 400 kilometres from Herxheim. The pits that surrounded the village provided no protection from invaders, but may have marked a symbolic boundary for a ceremonial settlement. At first, the team thought that the dead were brought to Herxheim for ceremonial reburial, but the new research has changed the opinion after they analysed 217 reassembled human bones from one deposit, representing at least 10 individuals. Damage typical of animal butchery appears on the bones, including that produced by a technique to separate the ribs from the spine. Heads were skinned and muscles removed from the brain case in order to remove the skull cap. Incisions and scrapes on jaws indicate that tongues were cut out. Scrape marks inside the broken end of limb bones indicate that marrow was also removed. Planned chemical analysis of the bones from Herxheim will indicate whether some individuals grew up eating foods from distant regions, a sign that they were transported to the site. Such evidence would support either a cannibalism or a reburial hypothesis. Whatever actually happened at Herxheim, facial bones were smashed beyond recognition, giving an impression of the destruction of individual identity, a kind of psychic violence against the person. Well, that was a pleasant story from archaeology. Archaeological finds from Britain show that farming was introduced 6,000 years ago by immigrants from France, and that the ancient Britons might have continued as hunter-gatherers had it not been for innovations introduced by their Gallic newcomers. Mark Collard from Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada, and his colleagues studied carbon-14 dates for ancient bones, wood and cereal grains from locations across Great Britain. From this, they were able to assess how population density changed with time, indicating that around 6,000 years ago, the population quadrupled in just 400 years. This increase coincides with the emergence of farming in Britain and was so quick it could not have come about from the indigenous hunter-gatherer communities alone. The only conclusion is that agriculture and people came from northwest France. Pottery remains and tomb types suggest the first immigrants came to southern England, followed around 100 years later by a second wave from northeast France, which settled in Scotland. Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation research has shown that an area of desert in northwest China was once a thriving Bronze Age manufacturing and agricultural site. The new findings may help shed light on origins and development of the earliest applications of Bronze Age technology. Dating was used to identify the age of seed, slag, copper ore and charcoal at two sites. The findings show the material is up to 3,700 years old, but the smelting was being carried out as recently as 1300 years ago. The research indicates bronze production may have begun as early as 2135 BCE, and that the modern mine location was possibly the historical source of copper ore for this manufacture. Professor John Dodson conducted the research in conjunction with scientists from the State Key Laboratory of Lewis and Quaternary Geology in China. This research takes us a step closer to discovering the origins and development of bronze manufacture in China. And further research will look at whether bronze technology was invented in several places around the world independently, or whether the technology was transferred from a single centre of origin. The research used lead and strontium isotopic analysis to identify and date ornaments, knives, rings and hemispherical objects, as well as spearheads. The Bronze Age people of the Gansu area were farmers who planted cereals such as wheat and practiced animal husbandry. Horse and sheep bones are common. It's believed that they may have abandoned the region when wood was exhausted and desertification took over. That's again another warning to the future, if not the present. A burial ground and archaeological site dating back millennia are at the heart of a long-running saga between a developer and a First Nations community in British Columbia, Canada. Archaeological investigations at Somenos Creek near Duncan on Vancouver Island have uncovered material as old as 4,600 years. The burial ground, which was in use for 600 years, is about 1,800 years old. An excavation undertaken by the University of British Columbia in 1994 revealed a shell midden, graves and artefacts that include a collection of chipped slate microblades, groundstone knives, bone awls and toggling harpoon valves. Well, there's a word you don't get to say very often. Of 33 additional excavations in 2007, 30 of them were of archaeological value. One of the most remarkable finds was a 2,000-year-old architectural feature that could be a house foundation. Another discovery was the remains of a young child wearing a 400-bead six-string necklace, meaning the child had some status. But the fate of the site has been hanging in the balance since human bones were discovered there in 1992. The Cowichan tribes want it to be preserved as a heritage site, but can't afford to buy it from the developer, George Schmidt. Schmidt's company Timbercrest Estates Limited, which had been developing the property since 1972, put construction in the area around the site on hold while archaeological excavations were carried out. Schmidt's relationship with the Cowichan people is pretty good, but they have been unable to come to any resolution. Schmidt comments that the provincial government either has to buy it or let him develop it, because they can't let it carry on like it is. In the hope that the province will buy the site, Schmidt and the Cowichan tribes met with Kevin Kroeger, Provincial Minister of Tourism, Culture and the Arts, on November the 4th this year. Kroeger's office did not respond to a request for a comment, but Diane Hinckley of the Cowichan Tribes Land Research Director says the meeting was positive. McClay says that although British Columbia has some of the strongest heritage legislation in North America, the archaeological branch has a staff of just 15, all of whom are based in Victoria, to regulate approximately 33,000 archaeological sites across the province. It's an unfortunate situation where heritage preservation is trumped by land development for the most part. And he really doesn't think that there's a need for greater, sorry, they really do think that there's a need for greater public education regarding the importance of these sites and their importance to the First Nations. An excavation team has unearthed an ancient burial mound dating to the first millennium BCE in Iraq. The Antiquities Department in Arbil said that the grave was found in the central part of the town and that the authorities then had to purchase houses to make way for the dig. Arbil is reputed to be the world's longest continuously inhabited site in the world, and the modern city is built around an ancient mound with several archaeological layers on top of which stand fascinating old-style houses. In a statement, the department said that excavations were at the initial stages and Iraqi scientists had joined foreign colleagues on the dig. Well, that's actually very heartening news to hear. Archaeology is back. Archaeologists have discovered rare gold objects from the time Hungarian tribes first arrived in the Carpathian Basin. Tibor Paluch, archaeologist of the local museum, said that the relics, thin golden sheets to cover the eyes and mouth of a dead person, had been found in one of eight early graves. He added that warriors had been buried in six graves, which included the skulls of horses. Hungarian experts have only once found similar artefacts before, at an excavation near Eger in the 1960s. Emerging archaeology is a new study highlighted by the Old Temple Study Foundation, suggesting that sound and a desire to harness its effect may have been equally important as vision in the design of humankind's earliest ancient temples and monumental buildings in Malta. Joseph Farugia, science officer at the Hal Safaleni Hypogeum, a multi-levelled complex of caves and ritual chambers, describes unusual sound effects in the UNESCO World Heritage Site. There's a small niche in what they call the Oracle Chamber, and if someone with a deep voice speaks inside it, the voice echoes all over the Hypogeum. The resonance in the ancient temple is something quite exceptional. You can hear the voice rumbling all over. As anyone who sings in the shower knows, sound echoing backwards and forwards and amplifying itself from hard walls can do unusual things. That effect is magnified several times over in the stone chamber. Standing in the hypogeum is like being inside a giant bell. You feel the sound in your bones as much as hear it in your ears. The Consortium Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research are pioneers in the field of archaeoacoustics, merging archaeology and sound science. Directed by physicist Dr. Robert Jahn, the group set out in 1994 to test acoustic behaviour in megalithic sites such as Newgrange and Wayland Smithy in the UK. They found that the ancient chambers all sustained a strong resonance at a sound frequency between 95 and 120 Hz, well within the range of a low male voice. In subsequent testings, stone rooms in the ancient temples in Malta were found to match the same pattern of resonance, registering at the frequency of around 110 or 111 Hz. This turns out to be a significant level for the human brain, and whether it was deliberate or not, the people who spent time in such an environment were exposing themselves to vibrations that impacted on their minds. Findings indicate that people exposed to resonant sound in the frequency of 110 Hz would have been turning on an area in their brain that biobehavioural scientists believe relates to mood, empathy and social behaviour. It's logical that the ancient temple builders observed the echoes and sound characteristics in the caves and came up with an idea of recreating the same environment in a more controlled way. Were they doing it intentionally to facilitate an altered state of consciousness? There's a lot that we will never know. Research about Malta's temple culture has been documented on a DVD available from the foundation at the following website. It's www.otsf.org. www.otsf.org/legacy.htm. That was www.otsf.org/legacy.htm. Among the lectures planned for the next few weeks at the Wiltshire Heritage Museum in England, here are a couple worth getting along to. Illicit Antiquities, A Scandal of Our Age by Christopher Chippendale, and Silbury Hill, The Archaeology of a Monumental Mound by Jim Leary. The world's great museums continue to unveil and show off ravishing new antiquities, especially from the classical world. Where do these treasures come from? In a growing scandal, it becomes increasingly clear these are not forgotten curios excavated long ago and recently gathering dust in the attics of Swiss bankers, but new finds recently looted and illicitly exported from the countries of origin. Why? How? Dr. Christopher Chippendale, reader in archaeology at the University of Cambridge, is a pioneering researcher in this troubling field, and we'll talk about it on Saturday the 19th of December at 2:30 p.m. Booking is recommended and the cost is £4. Now, in 2007 and 8, English Heritage undertook major works to stabilise Silbury Hill, parts of which were collapsing due to the effects of several tunnels and shafts which have been dug into the hill over the last 200 years, particularly the large tunnel dug by R.J. Atkinson in conjunction with the BBC in the 1960s, which had never been backfilled. Before the tunnels were filled with chalk to prevent further erosion and collapse, the opportunity was taken to make an archaeological record of the inside of the hill. The sides of the tunnels were cleaned and recorded using high-resolution photographs, and environmental samples were taken, including biological remains such as insects, pollen and snails, and a number of artefacts including flint and antler tools were also recovered. Radiocarbon dating of this archaeological material will allow specific dates to be attributed to the different stages of construction. Jim Leary has been working since the survey on the analysis of the data. The full report of the work, which is being prepared for publication, should answer some of the questions about this important and enigmatic monument, such as how was it built, when was it built, and how long did it take to build? Well, Jim will talk about all of this on Saturday the 23rd of January in 2010, again at 2:30 p.m. Once more, booking is recommended and the cost this time is £5. If you want to book this, then contact the booking secretary on 01380 727 369 or send an email to wanhs@wiltshireheritage.org.uk. That was wanhs@wiltshireheritage.org.uk. Well, it's just a pity I'm up here in Scotland. I would go down to that one. But while we're talking about Scotland, here's a tale of two stones. Westertown is situated about 8 kilometres northeast of Huntly in Aberdeenshire. This is an area with many ancient sites, including several stone circles and cup-marked stones. The Westertown stone is 2.2 metres in length and 1.5 metres wide, with 12 plain cup marks. Unfortunately, anyone looking for this cup-marked stone will be wasting their time, as the farmer buried the stone several years ago in the same field in which it had rested for many years. The reason given? He couldn't be bothered driving around it anymore. Meanwhile, at Corskelly, a magnificent cup and ring-marked stone was found, and here the farmer displayed the stone along with two others on a platform beside his new barn. Surely this would have been a much better answer at Westertown than just burying it. Researchers have found sediment on the ocean floor of France, which originated in the north of the Channel, which must have been transported by the river originally fed by the Thames and the Rhine. The samples taken from the Atlantic seabed have provided scientists with the final piece in a geological jigsaw, enabling them to reconstruct the story of the Channel River, a giant waterway that flowed through the area now occupied by the English Channel. Earlier studies had already suggested that the river existed during a sequence of ice ages that began 450,000 years ago. It formed when a huge glacial lake in the North Sea overflowed, causing a prehistoric mega flood, which sent water surging into the basin between France and Britain and gouging through the hills of chalky rock connecting them. To date, however, the timings and nature of the river have been based on a mixture of evidence from the English Channel and sedimentary deposits in the coastal Europe, many of which are incomplete due to erosion. An Anglo-French team of researchers claim they have found a more perfect record of the river's existence beneath the sea. The study was carried out in the Bay of Biscay, where the Super River met the ocean and discharged layers of sediment, which have gone undisturbed for thousands of years. Like a huge conveyor belt, the Channel River carried sediments from northern Europe towards the sea. As it met the ocean itself, however, the conveyor stopped and its energy was lost, leaving the perfectly preserved layers of sediment behind on the ocean floor. As a result, the team were able to test their samples for points at which they contained sediment from the Super River and for the intervening periods when any deposits were left as a result of normal sedimentation, since the channel was submerged. The study revealed conclusively that the Channel River existed during three different ice ages, 450, 160, and 90 to 30,000 years ago. In each case, the volume of the sedimentary material increased significantly, the result of the surges of debris pouring into the Bay of Biscay. The implications for British prehistory of knowing exactly when the ice and the river were at their height are profound. During glacial periods, the water level fell significantly enough to allow plants, animals and humans to cross into Britain. In temperate times, however, Britain would have been cut off, as it is now. And talking of the Paleolithic, a group of naturalists, not naturists I first written here, a group of naturalists from Amaravati district in India have discovered a set of 17 unique cave paintings in the Satpura range of Madhya Pradesh, which is believed to be Paleolithic in date. The first cave with rock paintings was spotted in January 2007, and they've so far found and surveyed 65 rock shelters and found 17 cave paintings. The first cave, which was visited, is facing the north and is in good condition, and with more than 50 rock paintings comprising mainly of animal figures such as a herd of spotted deer, rhinos, a group of wild dogs, bison, blue bull, tiger and more. The stags are painted very prominently with long antlers. Many of the paintings are red in colour, made of iron oxide. Well, on that exciting note, it just goes for me to say thank you very much for bearing with us just now. And if you're interested in archaeology and perhaps even getting involved in archaeology, there's nothing to stop you from getting along to Past Horizons. That's right, www.pasthorizons.com. There you can find 10 issues of our free online magazine. You can search over 350 archaeological projects around the world that you can get involved in. And of course, buy the tools you'll need to dig them. Can I remind people as well that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities in the UK are available at the fabulous Badger website, www.badger.org. And more can always be found at stonepagesnews.stonepages.com. Thanks very much for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. We hope that you'll return next week, and I have to say, so do I.